Juno Diaz is an American writer, and if that upsets the likes of Bill O'Reilly or even New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, it's probably just fine with him. Juno Diaz is a Dominican-American creative writing professor at MIT. The New Yorker called Juno Diaz one of the 20 top writers for the 21st century. Now, I have to say, sir, that's a little early in the 21st century for being given that accolade, don't you think?
Well, we seem to have a tendency to exaggerate in our culture, so I'm sure that's a part of it.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
Juno Diaz is also the Pulitzer Prize winner of The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde and a MacArthur Genius. That piece of music, I discovered it when I was listening to an interview you did on Alt Latino on NPR, Manchi and Alexandra, Hoyo en Blanco, The Blank Page.
Sí, Hoyo en Blanco.
And you said the song expresses the Dominican diaspora. Create beauty despite the scattering. As an artist, this is something you're still trying to achieve.
No, I think so. I mean, part of the nature of living a life amongst a distributed community is that you're always trying to both understand it and understand where in the world does your own family and your own personal history fit into all of it.
I like the other thing you said. You said when you're talking to the host of the show, you said academics and politicians say there's no such thing as a Latino identity, but the kind of musicians we were listening to on that program, Alt Latino, and the kind of writers you were citing, knitting together a new identity in a nuanced and powerful way. Yeah, the Latino identity idea, people say, no, that's not true. There's Puerto Rican, there's Cuban, there's Northwestern Latinos. You're saying there's something larger happening.
Well, I think that people tend to be kind of absurd in this, because it's not as if every member of Latino community has had the opportunity to actually have time to think about who we are, what we are. Most of us, if you came up the way I did, we received a lot of prepackaged nonsense about who we were. And it's not like you heard both sides of the debate. So few of us had any ethnic studies classes, any cultural studies classes, got access to the deep history of who we were and who we are and how we are. And I think that, you know, my sense of it is that if you give people a chance to understand all of it, they're going to come to very different conclusions than the simplistic ones that we're being kind of spoon-fed.
What was that prepackaged nonsense we were getting spoon-fed?
Well, the idea that, that there's no such thing as common identities. That, for example, it's a possibility for us to have an American identity, that these people who come from this incredibly diverse, geographically diverse, politically diverse, that they can be held together by this strategic fiction called the nation, but that somehow Latinos are excluded from this probability. I just think that's kind of having it both ways in a way, you know?
It is having it both ways, isn't it? I mean, I'm a Jewish American, and that means that I have a connection to a group of people I intersect with in different cultures, right?
Yeah.
Through media, through other things. But I still have that identity.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a perfect example. And I think, you know, what's interesting now is that these are really important questions for what's happening to the country. You know, you wouldn't know that the country is currently experiencing a transformation, not the way our politicians are acting, not the way our popular culture is acting, but anyone who works in high schools, anyone who works in elementary schools and middle schools sees the country changing at the speed of light. And yet it seems as if, you know, the folks who are in controlling of telling our kind of common stories haven't caught up to it at all.
Bill Moyers asked you an interesting question about the stories that were told around the Obama election. But I have that same question for what everything's a story. And there's a narrative that underlies the political debate that occurred about shutting down the government and Obamacare. What story did you see unfolding in that debate over these last 8 weeks?
Well, no, I mean, I think that there was an attempt to create from among the political elites to create a sham, to pretend that they were doing this In response to the citizenry, but they were, you know, doing this in response to their own childish, malign cruelties. I mean, when you think about the billions of dollars that this shutdown cost, billions of dollars that these same politicians would have fought tooth and nail to deny libraries and to deny pre-K education, it really gets down to the heart of what's going on among our political elites, that these are people who don't give a damn about us, who only care about their kind of, you know, attachment to their party lines. And, you know, they tried to attempt to spin this idea that this is a conversation that the country wants to have, that we need to shut down the country. Nobody believed them one lick except for their own, you know, internal crackheads.
Well, why do they have that ability to control their eternal crackheads?
Well, but look, I'm not a political science expert.
I know, but you think about
anyone else. Well, who doesn't? I think that we're in a situation where we have gone out of our way to permit the kind of gerrymandered districts that allow sort of unchecked lunatics to be elected, where, you know, there used to be healthy districts where someone would have to respond to other constituents. Nowadays, it's like everyone's got their own choir and runs their own little bishopric and doesn't have to respond to anyone. It's kind of insane.
Junot Diaz is our guest. I mean, I'm asking you political questions because you're thinking about art, and your art itself is steeped in culture and politics, and so are you. So you entered into the fray over the New York mayor's race during the primary, and I came across this clip. So outgoing Mayor Michael Bloomberg, he blasted Bill de Blasio for ads and appearances that featured his wife, who is an African-American, or who is black, and his two kids. And Bloomberg called the frontrunner's campaign class warfare and racist. You recorded a radio spot for the SEIU in response. Here's a little bit of that.
No. De Blasio intends to forge a new covenant for our city, one that prizes democracy over privilege, justice over...
Well, why not? I mean, because I think that's very interesting that you were looking at Mayor Bloomberg as a... What'd you call him? That he was an out-of-touch billionaire. It's the same as what was happening with the...
Sure, but I mean, that's just... this is just kind of... You got to understand a context for some of this stuff. I mean... Part of what happens to anyone who's doing work for a politician and a political figure, especially someone like me who's incredibly dubious of electoral politics, usually is to, because you're being called, favors are being called in by people who you really care about and people that you work with very closely, and because you're not so opposed that you won't fulfill or return the favor. So, I mean, I don't disagree with anything I said. I do think that... For a white mayor to say that, you know, a husband to show up with his black wife in a campaign ad, that's racist, it shows just not only how distorted the use of the word race has become, or the use of the idea of what's racist or not, but also just how utterly threatened someone like Bloomberg is by the presence of black bodies. The very presence of black bodies disturbed him so much that he was like, this is racist. What is racist? And he's like, I guess just the fact that they were.
You said that we ask art to pass a citizenship test or a loyalty test. You know, people wondering whether, can I read Junot Diaz because he's a Dominican writer? And you were saying, you know, Shakespeare wasn't thinking about another audience. He was thinking about his audience, but because he was... talking about truthful things, art reaches to everybody. That's why I find that the politics and art merging together is so interesting, because do you consider yourself a Dominican-American writer? You're just a writer.
No, I wouldn't say that. I actually wouldn't say that. I don't believe that any of us transcends into universal categories. I think that that's a way... The term writer or artist is a way that we obscure the matrix of privilege that tends to wrap these words around. Until a certain time, not long ago, when we meant writer, we meant white male. And generally, still the default, when we mean writer, we tend to mean white male, with an occasional bone thrown into white women writers. And so that usually it's an exception if there's a writer of color or there's a woman writer. And for me, I think that what's important is not to imagine that any of us transcend our localities, to become universal. But then when I read a writer, then I can immediately say Cormac McCarthy's a white male writer. That's not a big deal. Me identifying someone by who they may be or what category they may fit in, that's actually not a problem. The problem that I have isn't that people will identify someone as a woman or a man, is that for some people that actually means something. And I think that that's the deadly step, you know, and I think people tend to confuse one for the other.
In your book of short stories, these are stories about love and loss. And that's what was interesting about that song. Also, stories about love and loss and people trying to recapture it. That's why I came back to that create beauty despite the scattering. And that's what personal love can be as well, right? You're scattered by the loss.
And me, yeah, I think I'm just interested in this idea that when I was growing up, narratives of love were always put on the other side of the gender fence, that this idea that boys weren't supposed to be interested in love stories. And it was something that I was sold on pretty well. And I think what fascinated me as an artist for this last book was thinking about, well, what would a book of love look like from a character who falls far from the romantic formula? You know, and this is what I kind of came up with. I said, you know, this is a guy who love stories would be about the dissolution of love. And that's kind of what I was pursuing.
You have flawed human beings in this, of course, because we are flawed human beings. And your job, you said, is to communicate those truths, even with love, instead of it being this romantic ideal. It's this thing that we have to trudge through, I guess.
Well, you know, we are held very, very much in very closely to this belief of love. And I think that there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, many of us are compelled, many of us are attracted to the purity, that kind of elemental purity of the idea, the possibility to have this transcendental love. And I kind of find my characters, even the ones who are most cynical themselves, are often led by it.
Juno Diaz is speaking tonight in Kane Hall, An Evening with Juno Diaz. Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you, man.